apartment before, understand where you can see them. Like we talked about various bars that are used as inducing agents. Have we talked about penal bar yet for epilepsy? Not yet. Okay, so we're going to talk about one with epilepsy today. But outside of that, those are the drugs that are pretty much clinically used for in that category. And they're either the ultra short acting, or very long acting. There aren't any intermediate acting bars that are going to be used. So today we're going to finish the anti-epileptics, or again, pretty close. Are there any questions about what we covered yesterday? Okay, I'm around if you have questions, so before next Friday, so feel free. Probably today's not a good day because they have a big biochem test, so if you have a question today, you might have to fight through all the biochem people to get to me, but unless you guys can't do that. Okay, so I forget where I got yesterday as far as the drugs. Did we get through carbamazepine? Start with it? Okay, so carbamazepine or CBZ, this is another kind of first line drug that's used to try and control epilepsy. And structurally, you're like, yeah, it doesn't really look like anything we've seen before. And I told you yesterday or the day before that that's going to be we're going to see that a lot with some of the newer, especially with the newer drugs. But it's very effective. It's very it's highly effective, relatively safe, and it's used quite frequently to put people on. Now, there are some drawbacks as well as advantages to using CBZ. Let's see, highly potent biomethane can be comparable to phenytoin, extensively biotransformed. Anything that's lipophilic, you're going to see a lot of metabolism. All right. Did Dr. Holt cover the mechanism of how carbamazepine works? Oh, you didn't cover anything? Yeah. Wait, he didn't get to antibiotics, right? Okay. I'm just going to tell you briefly how it works. So, sodium channels, okay? They allow the brain cells or neurons to generate action potential so that neurons can communicate over distances, right? And so what this drug, carbamazepine, is going to do is it's going to keep the gates closed by stabilizing the inactive state of the sodium channel. So if you do that, what effect are you going to have on the neurons?
They can't conduct.
They can't conduct, right? What's the problem with epilepsy?
Too much conduction.
So that's pretty much how it works. Sometimes you'll see an off-label use for carbamazepine being used to try and control ADHD, as a side note. Some of the side effects, we know we can't use any drug without having side effects. The side effects that are in blue are the most common. You will see a small tendency to produce Stevens-Johnson syndrome with this one, as well as some other types of rashes, but we care more about the expression of Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Let's see. Irritation to stomach. Actually, this should have probably been highlighted in blue, too. A lot of GI upset sometimes is associated with this one. You can oftentimes get around the GI upset, like nausea, you feel sick to your stomach, you don't feel so well. By just taking it with food or taking it after you eat, you can get around that. Now, a lot of these side effects, though, that we see is going to be very similar with most of your anti-epileptic drugs, so it's not like we need to get around that. Carbamazepine can increase the breakdown, if you will, or the metabolism of other lipid-soluble drugs because it induces the enzymes in the liver. And so by doing so means you're going to have interactions with anything lipophilic. So if you have patients taking like OCs, statins, anything that's kind of lipophilic, you're going to have a problem. Because why? It's metabolizing it, so are they getting the coverage that they need? No. Okay, so you might have to make some adjustments, you might have to increase dose, you might have to try and switch to the anti-epileptic drug. So those are ones you commonly see. You also have drugs that can inhibit the metabolism of carbamazepine. We talked about cefazidine a lot, and you will also find erythromycin used a lot. So these are two that can kind of inhibit it. switch. Ideally, you would just put them on something else, but if you can't switch, what would you do? Lower the dose,
right?
So that there's not big issues here. All right, we're behind, so I can't show you some of these cool video clips that I have. Okay. Phenol bar. I can't show you that. I forget what some of these are. Some of them are very cool, but we're behind schedule. Phenol bar is something that's used to be used as a first-line treatment, but today it's not used as a first-line treatment. You'll sometimes see it being used for children. Okay, remember one of the biggest side effects with barbs? Remember what we said? It's very what? Did we talk about it at all? Sedating? Right? Reducing agents? Yep. So that's a that's very problematic. And so with children, very young children, it's not as much of an issue. So it can be used with really young children. Or you'll see phenol bar used in combination therapy sometimes with adults, and that can be used there. The dose is really low. There are great advantages to using phenol bar because it's cheap. We know it has a lot, it's effective. We know it has a long history of being used effectively. But it is the drug of choice for small children. And actually, let me go back 1 second. Because small children are more susceptible to drugs, any xenobiotic actually, because their microbial enzymes aren't necessarily expressed fully, you have to be careful about Stevens-Johnson syndrome, because there have been some little babies that have been put on phenol bar and they've expressed Stevens-Johnson syndrome and it's killed them actually. Not because phenol bar is a bad drug or it's not effective or safe. It is. You just got to pay attention. You can't necessarily predict who's going to get express Stevens-Johnson syndrome or not. So just pay attention to that and watch the patients or advise the parents to watch their children when they're being put on that one. But it is very effective, and guess what? When you look at the structure, what would you already know it's very effective for? Convulsive type seizures. Because what? Has the aromatic substitution to it. Good. All right. It's not as potent or effective as phenytoin or carbamazepine, and that's okay. It's still what? What? Oh, that's for me. All right, let's see. Let's go back. Okay, we're gonna do fine. We still have one. Okay. All right. Okay. Another advantage is once-a-day dosing, so compliance isn't as much of an issue with this one. It's extremely cheap. We have a long history of it being used. It's very effective, not very costly, if you will. You got to pay attention, though, to the Stevens-Johnson syndrome potential. It does have some liver potential hepatotoxicity associated with it. And don't be surprised, it's interesting, we say we give it to kids, but don't be surprised, we talk about the sedating effects of the bar, but actually oftentimes it has the opposite effect on kids. So they'll be like really hyperactive when they get it. So that's kind of very common. One of the side effects that you see along with sedation if you have it in combination therapy with adults is along with the sedative effects, they'll also seem to get depressed. They don't really know why this is fully. They have theories, but we're not going to go into them. Okay, so obviously it can affect your mood, behavior, cause fatigue, and tons of other things, but overall, it's pretty effective. It just started working again? All right. You can read all about this. It has a long half-life, so that's another reason why it's effective, and it'll also increase the lethal side effects that are associated with this. We already talked, it's a potent liver enzyme-inducing drug, so because it can induce 3A4, you can also get the metabolism of other types of drugs if you're taking it at the same time. Okay. toxicity is rare because this is an overall a pretty good, safe drug to use. And sedation, you already know that. Does have the potential for Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Oh, supplementation. You're going to definitely want to supplement patients that are taking phenobarb because it could precipitate folate, vitamin K, vitamin, and cause vitamin D deficiencies. Now, you guys know the actually, you do know this because we covered a biochem. Vitamin K, vitamin D, and did we talk about folate and biochem? Okay, so these are things, just a good supplementation would make sure that the person is fully covered. All right, diazepam and clonopin, these are two benzos that can be used for what? What did we talk about last time? Seizures? Yep, we're talking about seizures. You use a benzodiazepine to control seizures?
Just the convulsing.
What do you mean by the convulsing? What do we talk about? It's a special situation. What? No, not well. Actually, you're right, Jason. But I was hoping you guys would call status right, epilepticus, right? Because these things are very lipophilic. But you're right, Jason, in the sense that this is the one also you would give kids that when they're prone to febrile seizures, right, a lot, when their fever spikes, you'll sometimes give them a little bit of diazepam. That part is right. But these guys generally are used to control epilepticus, right, the state of repeated seizures. They're very lipophilic, they get into the CNS very quickly, and they get it under control. Diazepam, remember, is, I should have put another one up here, too, because we talked about lorazepam, right? Lorazepam is actually one of the ones drugs of choice to try and control that. Then diazepam, then clonopin. And so, actually, it doesn't matter. It's still a benzodiazepine. But diazepam is frequently used to do that. It's very effective. It's very lipophilic. And so it's very great to give intravenously to try and control epilepticus. It does have a long half-life, but, you know, you guys know the drawbacks for using benzos, right? Dr. Lovestead hopefully taught you that, right? I'm assuming you know that, right? Are there any drawbacks using benzos?
Yes.
Yes. What are they, Ryan?
Dependence.
Yep, you can have some dependence, tolerance, it can affect your mood, it can sometimes cause depression. So there are drawbacks, but it's not like patients are going to be chronically on these benzos, right? Because they're not going to constantly get epilepticus, right? So we're not too worried about that. Okay, some side effects. Okay, clonopin, generally speaking, clonopin is not really used a lot to try and control tonic-clonic status epilepticus. Pretty much you choose lorazepam or diazepam. You can use clonopin to try and control absent seizures if, like we haven't talked about the succinamides, but we will get to it eventually today. If, like, your succinamide therapy has failed, we have one drug of choice for absent seizures. It's called ethosuximide, which we'll talk about. So, for example, if you've exhausted that option and you can't control it, you could put them on clonopin to try and control their absent seizures. Also, you could use clonopin to try and control, if you will, an epilepticus, non-convulsive situation as well. Clonopin will have higher side effects, though, compared to lorazepam and diazepam. And, you know, it is used, though. Okay. Anything lipophilic, you already know, is going to be extensively metabolized. Tolerance, we already talked about the problems with that. Okay. We talk about the drawbacks for benzodiazepines, though, but guess what? When you try and use a benzo to control epilepticus, are you using high doses of it? You think your dose is really high? It's not really high, so you're not going to have to worry so much about that. Okay, lots of side effects, though. Be careful, though. Like, if you have somebody on combination therapy taking clonopin, for example, complex absent seizures, drowsiness, sedation, shaky movements, behavioral changes, that's why sometimes people can be in a zombie situation, because if they're taking like three drugs that are trying to control their seizures, and they all have very comparable, similar side effects that sometimes you just can't get around, how are you going to expect them to function properly? All right, let's move on to some of the newer drugs. So gabapentin, lamotrigine, these are newer drugs, and they're structurally unrelated to what we've seen so far. What does this one look like? If you look at the structure and you're like, what does it kind of look similar to? Not drug-wise, generally speaking. It looks like an amino acid, yeah. And so they, structurally speaking, we haven't seen anything that is an amino acid type of derivative yet. But gabapentin is very frequently used to control epilepsy. It's also going to be used to control migraines as well. We'll talk about that in a second. But it's used for simple or complex partial seizures, and it's not metabolized by the liver. So you avoid a lot of hepatotoxic effects of it, and you avoid a lot of interactions with other anti-epileptic drugs. So because of that, it is safer, if you will, than a lot of the other drugs, and you won't have interactions with OCs like you will a lot of the other ones that we've talked about so far. Structurally, it's going to be very similar to GABA, but it's not going to bind to GABA receptors, actually. It's going to increase GABA concentrations and introductor hold. We'll talk to you about that and how it prevents the nerve cell, the neurons from firing by doing that. All right, I already told you about that. So what are the disadvantages, do you think, of using gabapentin? Anybody working on... Oh, that girl that sits there isn't here today. She usually speaks up. So I forget her name. What is it? anyway, who works in a pharmacy? Okay, have you guys seen this one?
Yeah.
Okay, so what's some of the disadvantages?
Yeah,
it has a shorter half-life. So compliance could be an issue if you have to take it a lot, of like every eight hours or so. And so compliance is the problem with this one. And from a price standpoint, is it pricey? Okay, so that's going to be an advantage. It also is going to be very, very effective. You're not going to have a lot of drug interactions here, and it doesn't interact with your OCs. It's rather lipophilic to some extent. It's going to be dependent on the pH dose, but it gets into the CNS pretty quickly. Dr. Holt will probably cover more about the pharmacology of it, so we're going to kind of skip through that a little bit more. Overall, it has a pretty good pharmacodynamic and pharmacokinetic profile. And let's see, not an inducer of hepatic enzymes, so that's good. You could use this a lot for either monotherapy, combination therapy, fewer side effects. That's another reason why it's so common. Broad therapeutic index. Okay. Short half-life, that's why you gotta take it so frequently. That's the biggest disadvantage to this one. Some drug interactions that I want to tell you about is naproxen. Okay, a fair amount of people take naproxen. If you take this at the same time as you take gabapentin, it can affect the absorption as much as 15 to 20%. So you just want to make sure people don't take it anytime close to taking their neuronin. Antacids will have the same kind of effect, so just try and, you know, make sure people don't take their antacids at the same time, because you don't want it to affect the absorption. If it hinders the absorption, then how is that going to affect your patient? Are they going to get the required dose that they're on? No. What if they take it, what if you're like, okay, just make sure Henry, Gary, whatever his name is, or her name is, right? Don't take your naproxen or antacids close to the time you take it. They take it, let's say they take it in the morning and they wait like 3 hours. Do you think it's safe for them to take them? Yeah, just try and avoid 2 hours before, 2 hours after taking their drug. All right, overall, it's a pretty safe drug, and the side effects really, they're no worse than what we see with a lot of the other ones, but actually side effects, relative to the side effects we see, they're pretty mild. So compliancy is going to be the biggest problem here with this. Now, remember when I said it can also be used to treat migraines? We do see this used. It's not a first-line defense by any means to control migraines, but it is used to control migraines. Now, up to this point, remember when we talked about, when we were talking about migraines, we talked about, okay, migraines are on a scale from 0 to 10, pain-wise, right? What were the 10 again? Okay, how many drugs do we have available to control clusters? Which ones? We have Emitrax, yep. IV. We have what?
Migranol,
yep. Capricot? Is that it? That's it, right? That's all we have to choose from. Gabapentin's another one, okay? So gabapentin is very effective as well for cluster migraines. So that's going to be an advantage, especially when you're trying to counsel somebody that might suffer from cluster migraines if you're not able to get it under control. And because if you don't see a lot of drug interactions and it's relatively safe and effective, this is a good option. One thing to pay attention to, though, is if you're going to take somebody off this drug, try and slowly titrate them off. The reason is because what did we say last time about a lot of, this can go with any anti-epileptic drug. Any AED, you just abruptly stop taking. And there are instances you got to abruptly stop taking it, right? What's one of those instances? Stevens-Johnson syndrome, right? But if you can get away with it, you can slowly titrate them off this or any AED, because why? You don't want to give them a seizure. And this, if you abruptly stop taking, especially your eye, it will typically lead to a seizure. So your patient might not be too happy with you. Recent NIH research is even showing gabapentin to be effective for menopausal women with hot flashes, and you might be like, okay, I mean, I'm not at that age yet, but I remember my mother suffering through it, and she said it was horrible. I remember my dad saying, I would need like 10 different blankets at night because it'd be the dead of winter, and your mother would be like, no blankets, and all the windows open and stuff. So, you know, some women who suffer from that, I guess, you know, might want treatment, and so the NIH is actually showing its effective for hot flashes. Yep. I can't hear you that well. Your mics are on, so.
No. Yeah.
It should be. Try it.
All right. Well, okay. Cluster migraines or gabapentin. Would you say that's an indication or is that an off-label use?
No, it's used. It's just another use for it. Like, if for example, you have somebody that has clusters, and let's say you're trying IV Imitrex, not working. So you're trying Migranol, not really working. You can try gabapentin and it's very effective, so I want you guys to know that. Because there's not that many drugs we have available that can treat clusters. And remember, because clusters are the most painful, and you want to get those under control because of why? One second. Because of why? Sorry, Gary, we can't get your clusters under control. Just suck it up, right? Is that good enough? What did we tell? What did I teach you? Could have a stroke, right? And your patient is in agonizing pain, severe pain. So you want to get this under control right away. So gabapentin gives you another option.
Do you still try the other ones first before gabapentin?
The current medical treatment is you're going to, typically they'll try IV Emitrex first for clusters. Then they would try, and the reason is because the triptans have fewer side effects, your ergotriptans have more side effects that are associated with it because they're less selective, more vasoconstricting. So then they might say, okay, well, let's try Migranol after that, you know, and then they might go to gabapentin.
Is it prophylactic, or do you take it when you get the cluster migraines or gabapentin?
For cluster migraines, what would you want to do? Can you predict when you would get it? No, and you wouldn't want somebody taking this just prophylactically, so you would only take it when you get it, okay? But it is effective for cluster migraines. All right, let's see, what else do I want to say? All right, we already alluded to that. We already talked about antacids. Okay, lamotrigine. Structurally, this is another one that's unrelated to anything we've kind of seen before. Now, brand name, what might you want to make sure you don't confuse it with? Lamisil, right? Which is an antifungal. It's very similar, not very similar in acting. Like they are two completely different drugs, obviously. Just be careful with that, because you know you might say, yeah, I know, what idiot it's you know, has very minimal side effects. There's one big drawback to lamotrigine. Guess what it's going to be? What? It's explosive.
They said
A migraine pill seems to help alcoholics taper off their drinking without detox treatment. So they're talking about Topamax, and they're talking about the effectiveness, and they get into some of the side effects, but when you look at the study, it says by the end of the study, 27 of the 183 people, or roughly 15% who took the drug, quit drinking after 7 weeks or more. So they're like thinking, I personally don't think 15% is that impressive, but they seem to say, well, it seems to be effective in trying to get people off drinking. I say it's not really the side effects that are going to come with, especially taking the risk with somebody who's an alcoholic, seems to be not a good idea, but 15% is 15%. Some effectiveness. Topamax is a broad spectrum AED, though, and usefulness, this can be useful with absent seizures, and so this is a benefit with this one. You don't see as much protein binding, 18 to 24 hour half-life, so this is way long. And so this has an extremely long duration, and 70% of this is excreted unchanged in the urine. So guess what? How do you think this is going to reflect on drug interactions or adverse effects? Not many, right? And it's not, you're not going to have a lot of interactions with other AEDs. So this one's pretty good. All right, mechanism. Let Dr. Holt try and tell you the full mechanism, because a lot of the full mechanism they just don't know. So we'll probably tell you the same exact thing, which is nothing new with other drugs. Okay, let's read through that. Adverse effects, we see a lot of these same things coming up over and over again. It can induce 3-8-4 though, because it induces 3-8-4, you might have some further metabolism of other drugs if they're on it, so it's just something you have to pay attention to. It will decrease the effectiveness of OCs, and you don't really want to take this one if you're pregnant. Okay, the next one is valproic acid. Okay, what does this look just like, generally speaking? It looks just like, think biochemistry. Where did you see something that looked like this before? What? Just guess, it's not that big of a deal. You have carboxine, alkyl, fatty acid, right? Looks just like a fatty acid, right? So it's a fatty acid derivative. All right, one thing I want to talk about with this one is another article, I can help myself. So mortrevir is linked to epilepsy drug. So valproic users, kids have higher rates of retardation. Don't ever give this to anybody that's pregnant, okay, ever. And the reason is because they did this huge study and they said that women that took this drug while pregnant gave birth to children who were mentally retarded, double the rate of women that didn't, okay? Do you think you want to get pregnant? Do you think you'd have a line of women saying, yeah, I want to give birth to a child that's mentally retarded? No, obviously, and 50% is significant, so don't give this drug to anybody that's pregnant. And they're talking about fetal death. 1 in 5 women who took the drug experienced stillbirth, and so that's not good as well. And they're talking about the IQ of children, and it is significant how it affects the IQ the longer you take this drug, especially while pregnant. So the take-home message is don't ever give this one, regardless if you're pregnant. It is a very effective drug, okay? You can use it as a first-line treatment. It's broad-range use, if you will. It can even diminish absent seizures. And it can reduce the incidence and severity of tonic-clonic seizures. So this is really good, and it's much better than what we've seen before because it can kind of tackle both. You can also see this being used with migraines a little bit. It can show some effectiveness with migraines, and it won't interfere with OCs, regardless of if you're using it to treat migraines or you're using it to treat epilepsy. Okay, metabolism, you can read through that. It does have the potential, though, for some liver and pancreas toxicity, and only during the first, usually you'll see it being expressed during the first few weeks of treatment, so you want most vulnerable to that kind of toxicity. Risk is going to obviously decrease as you get older. All right. The two major metabolites that seem to be responsible for the side effects are these. And this one right here, the 4-ene valproic acid, is the one that's responsible for the liver toxicity that we're talking about with Depakote. And so anytime you have somebody that starts out taking this, it's not uncommon that you might want to monitor your liver enzymes because you want to know what's going on with that because it does have the potential for that. It's going to be dose-related, dose-dependent, though, so smaller doses will have a smaller chance. Higher doses will have a larger chance. Mechanism, you know, Dr. Hall can tell you about some of the things they know, some of the things they don't know, but they still don't know the full exact mechanism of this one. The one thing I do want to talk about from a drug interaction standpoint, though, is aspirin can displace it from its binding site, and it'll inhibit its metabolism. So basically, it'll compete with aspirin for the site, and so if you take it at the same time, and so it can increase the plasma concentrations and inhibit its metabolism. So you just want to make sure that they don't take it with aspirin or anytime close to aspirin. It's not that just because they're on Depakote they can't ever take aspirin. It's just you don't want them taking it anywhere, you know, again, that hopefully 2-hour window. All right, side effects. You see a lot of the side effects will increase, obviously, as you increase your dose, but we've seen nausea, we've seen shaky movements, we've seen the drowsiness, sedation. We've even seen a lot of the hepatotoxicity potential with other drugs. You generally see a lot of GI upset with this one if you're going to see anything. And so you can try and get around it by making sure they don't take it on an empty stomach. But side effects, you are still going to see the shakiness associated with this, the sedation, etc. Make sure you monitor the potential liver toxicity. And it can cause birth defects, so you're never, ever, 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 ever going to give this to somebody who's pregnant, regardless of whether you supplement with folic acid or not. Now, you can compare, this is a very old table, and it was trying to compare it to some of the other ones on the market. And at one time, it was being used way more than some of the other ones. But I need to download the newest table for 2009 because we probably wouldn't see that because look at where Neurontin is. All right, compliance is going to be an issue for each time you increase the dose. If your patient forgets to take the medication, you're going to see a higher incidence of seizure afterwards. So you just got to be careful about that. All right. Depakote in pregnancy, I already told you about that. You're not going to do it. All right, Keppra. This is the pregnancy category C drug. It has a moderately long half-life. And 66% is excreted unchanged in the urine. So what might this tell you?
It's not metabolized as extensively.
I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
It's not metabolized as extensively.
It's not metabolized as extensively. And how does it affect AED interactions or toxicity? Right, okay. Very effective for partial seizures. It's pretty safe, and it won't affect OCs. Again, I'm going to still give you the same recommendation. You're never going to stop taking it abruptly because it could bring on a seizure. The biggest thing you want to make sure your patients are aware of is just, again, ask them. If your moods change, if you start having like different kinds of thoughts or something, let me know because suicidal thoughts are associated with taking this one. A little higher than some of the other AEDs, and so you just want to make sure if somebody is getting depressed or kind of having suicidal thoughts, that you might want to switch them, right? But you would want to know that, so you know, don't tell your patients, well, if you start to feel like you want to jump off a cliff, let me know. Like, you know, you're not going to say it that way, but you can, you know, finesse it a little bit. Make sure that they let you know. Okay. Trileptal. Okay. Let's talk about trileptal because this one's a very good one. Not that others aren't good, but trileptal was designed specifically with carbamazepine in mind. And so, actually, when you look at the structure here, what do you notice? If you don't pay attention, you're like, Dr. Brunchard, these are the same exact structures, right? Bless you. You only see the reduction of that double bond, right? That's the only difference. And when they designed this, they had it in mind that they wanted to mimic the structure of carbamazepine because they wanted to improve upon some of the deficiencies of carbamazepine, which is used quite frequently. So that's how they came up with Trilecto. And this is very effective. It might increase the susceptibility to infections, though, because it could decrease your white blood cell count, and it will increase the metabolism of OCs. This one, like CBZ, has the potential to express Stevens-Johnson syndrome as well. But it's very, very safe. I would say it's a first-line treatment and very, very effective. You see fewer side effects with this one, and it's really good. The side effects are going to be, again, I feel like I'm a broken record here, but this is very similar with a lot of our AEDs. However, if you've ever had a patient that has been on CBZ and has ever had Stevens-Johnson syndrome or any sort of reaction to CBZ, you'd never put them on Trilecto because they're so very similar. So just be careful with that. Let's see. But this drug is the first one we've had in about 25 years that you can actually, and it's fully recommended as monotherapy for kids. I mean, when I say kids, really young kids. So kids that are like, you know, 3, 4, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like really young kids can take this one. And it seems to be very common. But you're going to see the drowsiness is going to be a big issue. All right, I think we only have a few more left. I'm tired already. All right, the next one is Zonegran, okay? This one is a sulfa derivative and has a very, very long half-life. We're talking days here, 63 hours, okay? So this one will give you very, very long coverage. That's an advantage. Another advantage to this one is it won't interfere with OCs. You're going to see the similar types of, for some reason, kidney stones. People that take this one, they'll have a higher incidence of kidney stones. They're still not realizing why that actually is. And you'll often see this one used in combination with other AEDs because 30 to 50% is excreted unchanged in the urine, so you're going to have fewer interactions with other AEDs. So you can use it with combination therapy more so than some of the other ones that are metabolized extensively. If you're going to choose drugs to use in combination, you're going to try and choose the drugs that you are metabolized or excreted mostly unchanged or metabolized to the least extent so that you can decrease that side of that type of interactions. All right, remember when I said ethosuximide? Remember when we talked about Klonopin? I said you could use Klonopin to treat absent seizures if, like, your succinamide treatment has failed. This is by far, this is the only succinamide I'm going to talk about because it's the only one clinically used. Ethosuximide, this is the drug of choice for guess what kind of seizures? Look and see. Tell me. Absent seizures, right? Because it's alkyl. Very effective, and it's by far the drug of choice that you get. The other succinamide drugs in its category are too toxic and have too many side effects. The downside to this one, though, is it will cross the placenta, cause birth defects, so you're not going to want to give it to anybody that's pregnant. Okay, metabolism-wise, most of it is converted to inactive metabolites, so that's really good. And you're not going to see as much interactions with that we have seen with some of the other ones. Side effects, we still see a lot of GI upset. We talked about this a lot. You can sometimes get around this, and I say sometimes. You can't always get around the GI upset people feel. They sometimes just can't get around that sick to their stomach feeling. But you sometimes can get away with that with just telling them to take it with food or after a meal, and they won't feel as sick. Drowsiness, dizziness, like agitation, these are some of the side effects we've seen with a lot of them. Basically, you feel mentally and physically sluggish, you know, and, you know, you just can't get away from that. All right, another one, has anybody seen primidone being dispensed anytime soon? Anybody? Okay. AstraZeneca is the company that came up with this one. And actually, a few years back, they were thinking of taking it off the market. And actually, looking at the structure, what kind of derivative is it? What does it look just like? Right. It looks just like a barb, except you're lacking that last oxo moiety, right? But other than that, it's a barb derivative, and this one has efficacy in most types of seizures except for what? What would you think? Except absence. Because why? Yeah, because of the aromatic substitution. The reason they were thinking of taking it, you have to take this frequently, that's another disadvantage of it, but the reason they were thinking of taking it off the market is because you produce a metabolite here that has the potential for toxicity, and so they figured there were too many other drugs out there, and the chances of the toxicity are making people use the other ones more frequently, and so they were going to take it off the market, but there are people that get significant relief using this drug, so it's still used. If you, again, the same thing's true with all the other AUDs. If you stop taking it all abruptly, you're going to increase the incidence of an attack or an epilepsy. And this metabolite here we call PEMA is what has actually more activity than the parent compound. And this is what leads to sometimes the hepatotoxicity that you do see with this drug. So that's the reason why they were going to take it off. And it's overall, this drug is not as well tolerated as some of the newer generation drugs. And we have a lot of newer generation drugs to choose from. So you just got to be careful if you put somebody on that. All right, so we've talked about pregnancy. We've talked about, things that you want to be careful of. We talked about folic acid supplementation, much more than just regular folic acid supplementation. If let's say you or I that's not pregnant, right, suddenly decides, I think I want to have a kid. So you start taking your prenatals and you start increasing your folic acid concentration. The concentrations of folic acid that you or I would be taking would be much lower than the folic acid requirements for if you suffer from epilepsy, because we talked about that for those reasons. So you got to be careful about someone who suffers from epilepsy and they're pregnant. You're going to want to make sure their folic acid concentrations are higher. Now, we talked about drugs you definitely don't want to be on if you're pregnant, ones that you could potentially be on if you're pregnant. You have to does the benefit outweigh the risks? And when you start increasing drugs to the mix, you also increase incidence of toxicity to the fetus. And so overall, Depakote, carbamazepine have higher incidence in monotherapy with harm to the fetus than some of the other ones do. But you got to be careful. They like to say, malformations aren't really that high, and they do increase with increasing drug you add to the mix. But that's misleading in a way because, for example, we talked about Depakote, right? And how you see almost a 50% chance in even the kids that are going to not technically be mentally retarded, it's going to still decrease their IQ. They might not meet that exact level. And so it's not just 3% or 2%. You would have closer to 50% chance, and technically even the other 50% would still be affected somewhat in what their normal IQ would normally have been. Does that make sense to you? You got to be really careful when you're counseling patients with the anti-epileptics and if they are pregnant or plan on becoming pregnant. And you can look at major malformations, minor malformations, fetal death, etc. You can see the statistics that are up there. Okay, you guys have any questions?